We're going to start chapter 24 in our study of 2 Samuel today, and welcome all of you online as well.
Maybe 21.
Chapter 21. The remaining chapters of the book of 2 Samuel are what often are called an epilogue. There are four key topics here. This is not chronological. We are not certain when this happened during David's. Remember, David reigned for 40 years as king. And it would seem from the way in which it is structured that the author of 2 Samuel adds these on as just an important part of David's reign. Chapter 21 deals with the Gibeonites, and I've got to explain who they are, remind you, I suppose, who you are, and a summary of the war. Wars David had with the Philistines, and focused on the fourth Philistines. And chapter 22 is a psalm. It's David's song of deliverance. And I do want to analyze that. And then, we'll get through the remaining couple chapters then. But it's going to take us a bit to deal with chapter 21. Now, it introduces, the chapter introduces us with a statement. Now, there was a famine in the days of David for 3 years, year after year. Now, I'm going to stop there for just a minute. Again, here, to remind you, this is not chronologically following what happened last week with the defeat of the Absalom revolt and Shimei, all those things that we talked about. So the author is adding this for two reasons. Number one, I want to remind you who the Gibeonites were. Now, unless you are a really good student of the Old Testament and or you have just finished studying Joshua, you may forget who they are. But you got to go back to Joshua 9. What has happened, and I must tell you this story, so just listen, it'll give you a little bit of context. The war against the Canaanites has begun. In other words, the Israelites have crossed the Jordan River and are now beginning to claim the land that God had given to them by covenant. Jericho has fallen, Ai has fallen, and so on. David is moving. He's going to do that old divide and conquer rule. He's going to conquer the southern part of Canaan, and when he gets control of those, he's going to move to the northern part of Canaan, or what we today would call Israel. But nonetheless, before he goes into the southern part of the campaign, a group of Gibeonites come to him, and they lie to him. They deceive him. This is Joshua now. And they say, we are from way up north, way on the other side of the Jordan, but what we hear what you're doing, we're with you, we want to make a treaty with you, we want to make a covenant with you. And so Joshua hears this, that when you read the chapter, he does not consult the Lord, he does not seek the Lord's advice and counsel here, he makes an agreement with these people. And that agreement is a covenant, that agreement is a promise. We will, that they agreed to do, to come under Joshua's authority. In other words, become vassals. If I use the word vassal, do you know what I mean by that? A vassal, like a servant, a kingdom servant. So they would be the servants, almost like the slaves of the Israelites. As long as the Israelites would not conquer them, would not destroy them, what they were doing to all the other Canaanite cities. And so that is an agreement that Joshua makes. It's sealed. It's a covenant. The actual word for covenant is used there. Later on, Joshua finds out about their deception. He finds out that they lied to him, that they contrived this whole story about who they are and what they wanted from Joshua. But it's too late in the sense that it's too late. Joshua has made a covenant with them. And it's always important to remember, making a covenant is very important to God. You make a promise, you are to fulfill that promise. That's part of the story. Then, because they lied and deceived, in effect, Joshua makes them, and I'm going to use this word, although it isn't exactly right at that context, the slaves of the children of Israel. They will become that. So by the time we're in David's reign, they are vassals. They're serving Israel. They're doing a lot of the hard work. They're doing a lot of the menial work. Okay? But two things you have to remember. They are not Jews, and they had deceived Joshua, but there is a covenant between the Jewish people, the children of Israel, and the Gibeonites. That covenant must be honored. Okay, you with me? That's part of the context. Okay, there's a famine now in the land. Again, we do not know the chronology of this. but it's sometime during David's reign. And David sought the face of the Lord. And the Lord said, there is blood guilt on Saul and on his house because he put Gibeonites to death. I just explained who the Gibeonites were. Now, what is being referred to in verse 2? We do not know anything about this. The Bible is silent on what Saul did to the Gibeonites. But apparently what he did is he slaughtered a whole bunch of Gibeonites. Why he did it, when he did it, what the context was for doing it, we don't know. But this is the point. In doing so, he violated that covenant that Joshua had made. Okay? So the Gibeonites and God, and this is again the important, God is expecting Israel to honor that covenant. Saul did not. So the king called the Gibeonites and spoke to them. In verse 2, now the Gibeonites were not of the people of Israel, but were remnant of the Amorites. Amorite is the general name for the Canaanites. Although the people of Israel had sworn to spare them, Saul had sought to strike them down in his zeal for the people of Israel and Judah. And David said to the Gibeonites, "What shall I do for you? How shall I make atonement that you may bless the heritage of the Lord?" And the heritage of the Lord, that's a covenant, that's covenant language. The heritage of the Lord are the Israelites. Something has happened. I need to take care of this. I need to atone for this. What do you want me to do? The Gibeonites, verse 4, said to him, "It is not a matter of silver or gold between us and Saul or his house. Neither is it for us to put any man to death in Israel." He said, "What then shall I do for you?" Verse 5, they said, "The man who consumed us and planned to destroy us, so that we should have no place in the territory of Israel, let seven of his sons be given to us, so that we may hang them before the Lord at Gibeah of Saul, the chosen of the Lord." David responds, "I will give them." All right, now, by this I mean what the Gibeonites are demanding and what David agrees to is an example of talionic justice. This is the talionic justice of the Bible. Saul had broke the covenant, had killed, we don't know any of the details as I mentioned, had killed a whole bunch of Gibeonites. They are demanding that seven of Saul's sons be executed. This is not a matter of vengeance, it's a matter of justice. David understands that, and David agrees to do it. Now, it's very important, I hope you caught that, they're being very specific. Seven of the remaining sons of Saul is what they're demanding.
So Saul has lots of sons because he has all these wives.
That and all his concubines, that's exactly right. So this is a horrible way to talk about it, but his primary sons are dead. Jonathan and a bunch of others. But there are other sons through his other wives and concubines and so on that still live. And that's what David agrees to do. All right. So two things. You got to remember who the Gibeonites are. And the second, you have to see this as an act of talionic justice, not vengeance. In other words, the Gibeonites could just have, and this is, in one sense, this is kind of important. The Gibeonites could just have started killing a whole bunch of Israelites. But they're not going to do that. Obviously, David would respond to that. They're asking for a just solution. And God, because God sent a famine, David inquired of the Lord. David found out that it's because of what Saul had done. This is all in the context of God's understanding of justice, and that is talionic justice, the law of retribution. You violate a covenant, you must pay for that violation of the covenant. And that's what's going on. So how's David going to do this? How is he going to carry out this? Well, verse 7 tells us he spares Mephibosheth. Who's he? He is the son of Jonathan because of the oath the Lord made between Jonathan and between David and Jonathan, son of Saul. So whom does he choose? Verse 8, the king took two sons of Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah. Now let your eye go down to verse 11. Aiah was a concubine of Saul, whom she bore to Saul, Armani, and Mephibosheth. This is not the Mephibosheth of Jonathan. This is another one. And he took the five sons of Merah, the daughter of Saul, whom she bore to Adriel, the son of Barzillai, the Naphtalite, and he gave them into the hands of the Gibeonites. They hanged him on the mountain before the Lord, and the seven of them perished together. He puts them to death on the first day of harvest, at the beginning of the barley harvest, which would be in the spring, March, April, is when that would have occurred. Now, I want your eye to go back up for just a moment to verse 6, because this all is done in Gibeah. Gibeah was the hometown of Saul, and Gibeah is just a little bit to the northwest of Jerusalem. It's up in the land grant of Benjamin, but it's not very far from Jerusalem. So they're doing it at the capital city of Saul's, when Saul was king, Gibeah, and that's his hometown. So all of this is happening there. It is all about Saul. All right. So, I mean, you just, at one level, you say, good night. These guys woke up one morning ready to start their day, and they find out they're about to be executed to deal with something their father had done many, 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 many years ago. Immediately, Americans will say that's not fair, and I'm not going to defend it all, except this is the view that is necessary for Talionic justice. Saul violated a covenant. Someone must pay for that violation because he slaughtered a whole bunch of Gibeonites, and it's going to be Saul's descendants.
Is this where we get the sins of the fathers will go down?
It is part of that, Bill. That's part of that talionic justice idea that there is retribution, and it can extend through generations in God's economy of things. Now, verse 10 and following is a tragic type of picture, a tragic type of story, because the mother of the daughter of Aiah, who is one of Saul's concubines, her name is Rispa, the daughter of Aiah took sackcloth and spread it for herself on the rock from the beginning of the harvest until the rain fell upon the heavens. And she did not allow the birds of the air to come upon them by day or the beasts of the field by night. When David was told that Rispa, the daughter of Aiah, the concubine of Saul, had done, David went and took the bones of Saul and the bones of his son Jonathan from the men of Jabesh-Gilead, who had stolen them from the public square of Beit Shan. Now, what is going on here? Now, again, this is so unimaginable for us in many ways. But when the text says they were hanged before the Lord at Gibeah of Saul, these seven sons, they hang them on the mountain. This is a hill outside of Gibeah. They stay there. The bodies stay there. I don't know how else to say it. The bodies stay there as they rot. Now, this was part of execution in the ancient world. You could talk about in Persia, Babylonia, and this is a public display of someone who has violated the moral law. This is an example. The populations are to look at that, and that's an example. This is what can happen if you violate the moral law. Well, Rispa, the mother, is protecting the bodies of her two sons from the animals, from the scavengers, from the birds. I mean, it's a horrible thing to envision. You get a mind picture of this. It's gruesome. And so as she rescues her sons when the rains fell from the heavens, so this is several months, David then orders that not only the bones of these boys be rescued, but David also orders that the bones of Saul and the bones of Jonathan be taken from Jabesh-Gilead and buried in Gibeah. So this reminds David, and you know, this was, again, this is really hard for you and me to imagine this in the context of our world, but the Jewish people, and not only the Jewish people, many in the ancient world, but we're focusing particularly on the Jewish people, they honored the bodies and the bones of their ancestors. And one of the things that is going on here is David wants to honor the promise he made to Jonathan and Saul. He was a former king. He's going to bring those bodies. They're going to have a decent burial. But one of the things that the Jewish people did, and it's beginning at this period of time, just let me briefly talk a little bit about it. The body would be buried almost always within a 24-hour period at the ideal. And at the end of the year, you would take the body, which, of course, after a year, the deterioration of the body is marked. You know, I don't think I have to explain it. Anyway, basically what's left of the bones. Then what they would do is they would wash and cleanse the bones. And they would take the bones of their ancestor or mother or dad or uncle, whoever it is, and put them in a family container. Sometimes it was a grave. But what developed is an ossuary. It's a box, a big box. And if you ever go to Israel and Jerusalem, I would always point these out. There's a huge area where you just see dozens of these ossuaries that they've uncovered. And always on the outside of the ossuary box would be the name of the family. And so what you're doing is you're honoring all your descendants by preserving their bones. And so in that box, you could have, well, I mean, some of the boxes are quite large. Some are smaller. It depends. But you could have in that ossuary box, you could have four or five generations of your ancestors. And this is, again, this is really gruesome. It's unimaginable for us. We don't do anything like that at all in our culture. But it is a way of honoring the body. It's also a way of honoring your ancestors. It's showing respect and dignity of your ancestors. That's what David is doing here. I'm just trying to give it a little context. What Rizpah had done in trying to preserve and protect the bodies of her sons who have been executed, this reminds him, the bones of Saul and Jonathan are still up in Jabesh-Gilead. I want to bring them back into the country, because Jabesh-Gilead is outside the country. And that's what he does. This is honoring the body. It's honoring ancestors. And that's what David does. And so verse 13, he brought up from there the bones of Saul, the bones of his son Jonathan. They gathered the bones of those who were hanged, seven we just read about. And they buried the bones of Saul and his son Jonathan in the land of Benjamin and Zelah, the tomb of Kish's father. And they did all the king commanded. And after that, the Lord responded to the plea for the land. Famine ends. And so, again, you know, it says in the land of Benjamin, remember, Saul is from the tribe of Benjamin. So he's buried near his hometown. That's what it's telling us. And there's a lot in here. You got to remember who the Gibeonites are. You have to understand talionic justice. And you have to understand that what is going on here and then what David decides to do is honoring the body and honoring former ancestors or former dignitaries of your kingdom. Such an extraordinary thing. Very unusual for us, but it's an extraordinary demonstration of a couple of key core values of the kingdom of Israel. Talionic justice, keeping of the covenant, and honoring the body. That's all a part of this chapter. It's a bit unusual, but are you with me? Do you understand that? I think it's important. Again, as I mentioned when we began this morning, these chapters that end the book of 2 Samuel are not in chronological order. The sense of this chapter is that this happens fairly early in David's reign, but we don't know that for sure. Now, verse 15 through really what is the end of chapter 21 is a summary of David neutralizing the Philistines, but it's organized around four Philistine leaders, and one of them is Goliath. There was war between Philistines and Israel, and David went down together with his servants, and they fought against the Philistines, and David grew weary. Here is the first Philistine leader, and Ishbi Benob, one of the descendants of the giants. Remember, Goliath was a giant. The Rephaim, had been incorporated into Gaza by the Philistines, whose spear weighed 300 shekels of bronze. That's 7.5 pounds. And was armed with a new sword, thought to kill David. But Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, came to his aid and attacked the Philistine and killed him. And David's men swore to him, "You shall no longer go out with us to battle, lest you quench the lamp of Israel." Figurative language for being killed. So what the Bible is doing here is it's organizing these final battles with the Philistine around four key Philistine leaders. First one, he's dead. Verse 18, after this, there was again war with the Philistines at Gob. And we don't exactly know where that is. There's a lot of discussion about that, but it's near Jerusalem. Now, Sebekai, the Hushite, struck down Saif, S-A-P-H, save, who is one of the descendants of the giant. And there was again war with the Philistines at Gob. So this is the second Philistine leader. Now the third one. And Elhanan, the son of Jerai, or Agim, the Bethlehemite, struck down Goliath, the Gittite. First Chronicles chapter 20, verse 5, when it's accounting of this, says this is the brother of Goliath. His name is Lachmi. I think that's probably what is going on here. The shaft of whose spear was like a weaver's beam, and there was war at Gath with a great man of great stature, who had six fingers in his hand, six toes on his foot, 24 in number. He also was descended from the giants. And when he taunted Israel, Jonathan, the son of Shimei, now this is not Jonathan, the son of Saul, this is another Jonathan, David's brother, struck him down. These four were descended from the giants in Gath, and they fell by the hand of David and by the hand of his servants. Four key Philistine leaders, they're all descendants of these giants, they're all killed. So it's interesting. It's an interesting set of stories, but it's organizing this finality of dealing with the Philistines around these four Philistine leaders who are giants. And that's it. A lot of critics of the Bible look at that verse in verse 19, the mention of Goliath. See, there are two accounts of the Goliath story, and you see David didn't really kill Goliath. Somebody else killed Goliath. That's the wrong way to look at it, because 1 Chronicles 20 helps us to understand this is the brother of Goliath who was killed, and that would make sense. All right. Now, I don't think there's any questions on that. If there are, feel free to ask them, but it's pretty much just a review of how D deals with the Philistines. Chapter 22 is a psalm, and I do want to spend some time on that. We don't study the psalms very often. Chapter 22 of 2 Samuel is identical to Psalm 18. So if you go to Psalm 18 in your Psalter, you know, the book of the Bible called the Psalm, you go to Psalm 18 and you look at 2 Samuel 22, they're the same thing, exactly the same psalm. So there's one or two differences, but they're very, very minor. So what I want to do is I want to look at this and study it with you. We don't study the psalms, but I want to do this. We're going to work our way through it. Because this is the Psalms are the songbook of Israel. There are 150 of them in the book of Psalms. David wrote about 72 of them, give or take. There's some dispute about a few of them, but around 70, 72 of the Psalms. He wrote a lot of them. This is one of them. It's a victory psalm. It's a psalm that David wrote and a psalm that the choirs of Israel would sing. One of the things that we often forget, or at least I'm not sure it's always emphasized very much, is that in the worship of ancient Israel, there was singing, a lot of singing. And they sang the songs of Israel, and a lot of those, which had various aspects to them, but a lot of those that are then incorporated into the psalm, the book of the Psalms. And there are 150 of them over a long span of history. But David wrote almost half of them, and they were sung. If you go to Psalm 18 in the book of Psalms, the superscription says, to the choir master, a psalm of David, servant of the Lord. And so what we don't have is the music. We have the lyrics, but we don't have the music. But we're also told in a lot of different parts of the Old Testament that they had a lot of instruments, the lyre, the flute, trumpets. They had something that would be a little bit similar to like a violin. So what we don't know is what it sounded like. But we have a couple of interesting comments. I'm going down a little bunny trail here, but please let me do that. When you read the book of Nehemiah, you remember Nehemiah was instructed by the Lord to build a wall around Jerusalem. That was to protect the holy city. The temple had been rebuilt after the captivity and all that. And they finally complete the building of the wall. And they have this fantastic celebration. And it in detail tells us how Nehemiah organized the choirs and they're marching all around the walls of Jerusalem. It says in the text, you could hear them singing 2 miles away. A little bit like what worship sounds like in your Sunday morning church, right? We're 2 miles away, people are hearing you sing. Not exactly, and obviously it was an enormous choir of people, but the one thing we know is that worship in ancient Israel was not soft, passive. It was loud. It was boisterous. And in a psalm like this, Psalm 18 or Psalm chapter 22, it's a very triumphant psalm. It's a psalm of victory. David wrote this psalm, that's why I think the author inserted it here, as a summary praise to God for God, all the victories that God had given to David as the king of Israel. And so it's just an extraordinary psalm filled with all of the figures of speech, metaphors, similes, and all the figures of speech that focus on triumph, victory, and it's God who's giving them that. So if you don't mind, well, even if you do mind, we're still going to do it, but if you want to work our way through this, it has a few key parts. There's a summary praise in verses 3 and 4. Then verses, really, it goes from 5 all the way through verse, where do I have it? Here it is. Through verse 20 is the summary of God's miraculous deliverance for Israel. And then verse 21 through 25, David's testimony, his personal testimony to the faithfulness of God. And then verse 26 through verse 46 is a summary of instructions and blessings to the people of Israel. And then there's a short doxology in verses 47 through 51. So let's read this together. I'll go through that outline in just a minute. Summary praise. The Lord is my rock and my fortress, my deliverer, my God, my rock in whom I take refuge, my shield, the horn of my salvation, my stronghold. I call upon the Lord who is worthy to be praised, and I am saved from my enemies. Again, he is writing this as the king. He's writing this as the commander of the armies. He's writing this about God's victories. Did you notice all those military figures of speech? My rock. That is used all over the Bible, where the Lord is my rock. The Psalms are filled with this. Why use the metaphor of a rock to speak of God? In this case, Yahweh.
Cut from the mountain without hands.
Yeah, when it has all these, a rock, and it symbolizes power, it symbolizes stability, it symbolizes security. And then he says, my fortress. The Hebrew word for fortress is Masada. Did you ever hear Masada? And of course, Masada becomes that great fortress, which is on the west side of the Dead Sea, which you can go and see today. My deliverer. And that, of course, is salvation, but also deliverer from enemy. My God, my rock, who repeats it. My shield. A third metaphor. First is rock, then fortress, deliverer. Then shield, you know what a shield is, the horn of my salvation. Very unusual, but in the ancient world, the horn of an ox, of an elk, of a deer, symbolized power and strength. So the horn of my salvation is to focus on the power of God. Again, my stronghold. I call upon the Lord who's worthy to be praised. Then verse 4, going all the way, excuse me, verse 5, going all the way through, I believe verse 20, is the summary of the deliverance that God gave to David. And I'm going to read this fairly quickly, but just look at all the different ways in which he describes his desperation, his near defeat, but how God rallied and won the victory. The cords of death encompassed me. The torrents of destruction assailed me. The cords of Sheol entangled me. The snares of death confronted me. In my distress, I called upon the Lord. I cried to God for help. From his temple, he heard my voice. My cry to him reached his ears. He's near death, and this would be in terms of a battle, in terms of a very serious defeat. He cries out to the Lord, and from the temple, in heaven, from the place of God's seat of authority. Look at God's answer. And this is all hyperbolic language. You know what I mean by hyperbolic? Language of exaggeration. But it's incredible, the word pictures he's creating. Then the earth reeled and rocked. The foundations of the mountains trembled and quaked. Behold, because he was angry, smoke went from his nostrils, devouring fire from his mouth. Glowing coals flowed from his forth from him. He bowed the heavens. Excuse me, he bowed the heavens. Bowed the heavens and came down. Thick darkness was under his feet. He rode on a cherub and flew. He came swiftly in the wings of the wind. He made darkness his covering, his canopy around him. Thick clouds dark with water. Out of the brightness before him, hailstones, coals of fire broke through the clouds. Now, he could be describing God answering with an earthquake and a violent storm, or he could be just describing when God acts, when God responds in answer to my prayer, he responds with power. He responds with might. Verse 13, the Lord also thundered in the heavens. Most High uttered his voice, hailstones, coals of fire. He sent out his arrows and scattered them. He flashed forth lightnings and routed them. And channels of the sea were seen. Foundations of the world were laid bare at your rebuke, O Lord, at the blast of the breath of your nostrils. You just see this incredible language of David recounting God's power and victory, answering prayer in the need of battle. He sent from on high. He took me. He drew me out of many waters. He rescued me from my strong enemy and from those who hated me. And for they were too mighty for me. They confronted me in the day of my calamity, but the Lord was my support. He brought me into a broad place. He rescued me because he delighted in me. And so this reversal of the situation, near defeat, but Yahweh's decisive supernatural deliverance. And the people of Israel would sing this over and over and over again. Can I go on a bunny trail for a minute? I hope I'm not going too far with this. When I got home Saturday night, actually late Saturday afternoon and into Saturday evening, Peggy said, you've got to turn the TV because Iran had launched all these drones and missiles toward Israel. There's such a long wait there because they knew they were coming. If you ever looked at a map, that was a long distance. And finally, as the evening went on, there were a lot of things going on. But they tell us 99% of those drones and missiles were shot down. A lot of coordination, a lot went on. But because I knew we were going to study this, I thought of this. I really did. I want to be very careful because tomorrow Israel could be invaded and destroyed and they go back into captivity. We don't think that's going to happen because of what Ezekiel 36 and 37, but God promised to defend his people. God promised to defeat his people, the enemies of his people. And I can tell you right now, although the United States and France and Britain and a number of other nations were coordinating, a lot of jets were in the air shooting these things down, but that was a remarkable preservation of Israel. That was an incredible, absolutely incredible demonstration of God protecting his people. Now, again, tomorrow, something else may happen. But it reminded me of God fighting for his people Israel. Now many of them are in land with unbelief. They don't recognize Jesus, but he's bringing them back to their land as he promised. And the language that David is using here is the language of what we saw. And so it's an illustration of what David is putting into a hymn. Lots of figurative language, lots of metaphors and similes and all that stuff. But describing what it's like when God fights for his people, like an earthquake, like a mighty storm. He's doing all that's necessary to defeat our enemies. And this situation is reversed. That's what verse 20 does, the reversal of the situation. He started, I was in the pit, I was near Sheol, I was near death. God rescued me. Now the second part is verse 21 through 25. Where David gives a very personal testimony here. The Lord dealt with me according to my righteousness, according to the cleanness of my hands, he rewarded me. For I have kept the ways of the Lord, have not wickedly departed from my God. For his rules were before me, his statutes I put away from me. I did not put away from me. I was blameless before him. I kept myself from guilt. So the Lord has rewarded me according to my righteousness, according to the cleanness of my hands in his sight. Now, David isn't elevating himself here. This isn't pride. What David is saying is, God fought for me because I was faithful to him. I took his moral law seriously. And because, and when he speaks of his righteousness, he says that in verse 21, he says it again in verse 25, he has this understanding of what the Apostle Paul calls justification, that he's righteous because of what God has done for him, not that he's earned it or merited it. He's giving a testimony to his faithfulness to the Lord. And then in verse 26, he takes this and he wants to instruct his people. God fought for us. I was faithful to the Lord. I was a good Deuteronomy 17 king. Now, people of Israel learn from this. With the merciful, will you show yourself merciful? With the blameless man, you show yourself blameless. With the purified, you show yourself pure. With the crooked, you make yourself seem torturous. These are people who are loyal to the covenant. For you save humble, this is God now, for you save a humble people, but the haughty eyes you bring down. For it is you who light my lamp, give me guidance. The Lord my God lightens my darkness. For by you I can run against a troop. By my God I can leap over a wall, overcoming the barriers on the battlefield. This God, his way is perfect. The word of the Lord proves true. He is a shield for all those who take refuge in him. These are general principles of life, but he's saying to his people, learn from this. This God, his way is perfect, people. Learn that. The word of the Lord proves true. Learn that. He's the shield for those who take refuge in him. Learn that. David is saying, I'm a living example of this. God was faithful. Learn this lesson in how you live your life in your walk with God. Then, kind of picking up in what is verse 30 and following, he continues these instructions. For who is God but the Lord? Who is a rock except our God? The God who equipped me with strength, made my way blameless. He made my feet like the feet of a deer, and set me secure in the heights. He trains my hands for war so that my arms can bend a bow. I've got so many papers here. I've got to get the right one out here.
Jim, this is Wood.
Yes.
Are you reading right out of the Bible, or do you have some kind of literature there that you're reading from? I'm finding an occasional difference from my Bible.
Well, I'm reading from Psalm 18, actually, because I have a lot of notes about Psalm 18. But it's Psalm 18 is identical to 2 Samuel chapter 22, Woody. But you're having a little trouble following that?
Yeah, a little bit. That's not bad. Pretty close. Just okay. Wondering if you changed Bibles. I'm still in my NIV.
Well, I don't want you to get lost here. I'm sorry if I've caused you to get lost. All right, let me pick up here. For some reason, I've lost the page here, but I'll find it when I get back to my office next week. But picking up, I think I'm in verse
32, I think.
Yeah, let me pick up in verse 35 the God who equipped me with strength and made my way blameless, he made my feet like the feet of a deer, set me secure in the heights. He trains my hands for war so that my arms can bend like a bonds of the bow. You've given me a shield of your salvation, verse 36. Your right hand supported me. Your gentleness made me great. You gave a wide place for my steps under me. My feet did not slip. These are just all things that he wants to review with the people as they sing. Speaking of God, I pursued my enemies and overtook them. I did not turn back till they were consumed. I thrust them through so that they were not able to rise. They fell under my feet. For you equipped me with strength for the battle. You made those who rise against me sink unto me. You made my enemies turn their backs to me. Those who hated me I destroyed. They cried for help, but there was none to save. They cried to the Lord, but he did not answer. I beat them fine as dust before the wind. I cast them out like the mire of the streets. You delivered me from strife with the people. You made me the head of the nations. People whom I have not known served me. As soon as they heard of me, they obeyed me. Foreigners came cringing to me. Foreigners lost heart and came trembling out of their fortress. And now the last part. The Lord lives. Blessed be my rock. Exalted be the God of my salvation. The God who gave me vengeance, subdued peoples under me, who delivered me from my enemies. Yes, you exalted me above those who rose against me. You rescued me from the man of violence. For this I will praise you, O Lord, among the nations. Sing to your name. Great salvation he brings to his king. Shows steadfast love to his anointed. And David, to David and his offspring forever. And so that last couple of verses reaffirming what Israel is, the Davidic covenant. Now, I hope you didn't mind going through this psalm. It's one of the great psalms of the Psalter. It's one of the great psalms that David uses in this section to praise the Lord. And it's instructing to the people. And when you remember that this would have been sung in the tabernacle and then later under Solomon and following in the temple, it would have been a triumphant song. I wish we could get a recording of what it sounded like when Israel sang these songs of deliverance, but we don't. We'll have to wait till we get to heaven. All right?
CD's not available.
Yeah, right. There were no MP3 players or anything like that. I don't think you probably have any questions, but if you do, let me hear them. Woody, did you follow me there at the end, or did I lose you?
No, I was right with you. Thank you.
Hey, Jim, I did have a question. When you talked about the chronology of these last chapters, do you get a sense that this would be, though, toward the end of David's life?
I believe so.
Okay.
Yeah, I believe so. Some of the Psalms, and as I mentioned, around 72, David wrote. We know exactly when he wrote them. Others, we don't. We don't know when he wrote this. But you're right, because of what he's saying and all that, it would seem reasonable that this is fairly near the end of his rule. Because the enemies that he subdued, and he mentions there briefly, it took him quite a few years to do that. So, very triumphant, but he's giving all the praise and glory to God for what he did for David. All right. It's about 12:30, so I'm going to get into chapter 23. And I think what we'll do here is, for the remaining moments, focus on verses 1 through 7 of chapter 23. Depending on the translation you have or that you're using, there's perhaps a heading over chapter 23, and it might read something like this: the last words of David.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, thank you, Woody. Okay. We're assuming that, because there's one more chapter to this book of 2 Samuel, but we're assuming that these are the last verbalized words of David. When you go to the book of 1 Chronicles, which is a parallel account of some of these events, these last words are uttered by David when he's literally on his deathbed. So I'm assuming that is the way we should look at it. I want to go through this carefully. Let me remind you of a couple of things about how the Bible wants us to understand King David. First of all, to understand King David, you must remember, in terms of his importance, the Davidic covenant. God made an unconditional unilateral covenant to David. And remember what that is: throne, dynasty, kingdom, eternal. That's a promise. And you and I can answer this question: who fulfills that covenant promise? Jesus does. Now, you and I know that. When David wrote, he didn't know that. But David understands his relationship with God through the grid of this covenant. That defines his relationship with God. That defines why God is faithful to him, but it also defines why he, the king, needs to be faithful to the Lord. So this is part of what David is saying here in these last words. Look at verse 1 of chapter 23. These are the last words of David, the oracle of David, the son of Jesse. Now, correctly, I read from the ESV translation, correctly, they're translating this oracle. Now, oracle today in 2024 has kind of a mysterious sound to it. We don't talk about oracles. But in a very real sense, an oracle is like a pronouncement, a declaration, a prophetic declaration. So it's a very serious word. So it's like a final prophetic declaration of King David. The oracle of a man who is raised on high, the anointed of the God of Jacob, the sweet psalmist of Israel. Notice those three descriptive phrases. The oracle of David, the oracle of a man who was raised on high. Now that's in the passive voice. Who raised him on high? God did. The anointed of the God of Jacob. When the Bible uses language like that, the God of Jacob, that's covenant language. Because remember, Jacob, in chapter 32 of Genesis, God changed Jacob's name to Israel. So you have this covenant language. And then he adds, the sweet psalmist of Israel. What we just read in chapter 22 is an illustration of that, the sweet psalmist. He wrote, as I mentioned earlier, somewhere around 72 psalms. There's always a little dispute about one or two of them, but around 70, 72, 73 psalms. So he is identifying himself as the sweet psalmist of Israel. I wrote a lot of the hymns of ancient Israel. This isn't pride. This is a prophetic declaration of what God did. Notice verse 2. The Spirit of the Lord speaks by me. You could translate that preposition through me. His word is on my tongue. Now, men, how do you and I understand that? Really remarkable declaration. The Spirit of the Lord speaks by me or speaks through me. As the sweet psalmist of Israel, as the man God raised on high, as the anointed one, that means Messiah, the Messiah of the God of Jacob, the Spirit of God speaks through me. Now, there's just one of those little tiny tidbits of information that helps us to build the authority of God's word. David is declaring that the Spirit of the Lord is speaking through me. When I write those psalms, his word is on my tongue. I don't know if you and I could go back 3,000 years and sit down and have coffee with David and say, David, do you believe your words are inspired? I don't know if he'd know what that word means. It's a word out of the New Testament. But whether he could identify as inspiration, he would say, well, I'm going to tell you again, the Spirit of the Lord speaks through me. I was conscious of that. I was aware of that. I took that very seriously. So it's a remarkable self-understanding of David and what he's writing. I find every time I read this, in my Bible here, I put a whole bunch of exclamation points after this verse. That's an astounding declaration. And he goes on in verse 3, the God of Israel has spoken. The rock of Israel, there's that metaphor which we read in chapter 22. The rock of Israel has said to me. Now, what I want you to do, and I think we can get this done before we break, is I want you to contrast when one rules justly over men, middle of verse 3, with verse 6, but worthless men. So it's going to set up a contrast between a just ruler and a worthless ruler. He, of course, will see himself correctly as a just ruler. When one rules justly over men, ruling in the fear of God, remember, fear in the Old and New Testament is a worship word. It is a response of understanding who God is and his power and his authority, and by contrast, understanding who we are. But when one rules in the fear of God, That also implies something very strong, very important, that that ruler is accountable to God. He dawns on them that he would be God, dawns on them like the morning light, like the sun shining forth on a cloudless morning, like rain that makes grass sprout from the earth. Now, they're all similes, you know, similes introduced by word like. So this rule by a just man who rules fearing the Lord, he dawns on them like, who's to them on the subject when he rules? Like a dawning light, sun shining on a cloudless morning, rain that makes grass. That's the characteristic, using similes, of a righteous ruler. For does not my house stand so with God? He has made me with me an everlasting covenant, ordered all things, since in all things secure. For he, will he not cause to prosper all my help and my desire? Verse 5 is a summary of the covenant. God made an everlasting covenant with me, ordered all things and secure. He will make this happen. Will he not cause to prosper all my help and my desire? That doesn't mean just a big bank account, but proper. He will fulfill what he's promised. He will prosper my house, my dynasty. So I love that meaning, verse 3, 4, and 5, because David has self-understanding of who he is, a self-understanding of the covenant, and he understood God did this for me. So when I write these psalms, I'm speaking for the Lord because he has blessed me with his eternal covenant. I only have a couple more minutes. Verse 6. But worthless men, again, this would be the other type of ruler. Worthless men are like thorns that are thrown away. They cannot be taken with the hand. You get that metaphor, don't you? You can't pick up a bundle of thorns. That's going to be impossible unless you have really heavy gloves on. Anyway, but the man who touches them arms himself with iron and the shaft of a spear, and they are utterly consumed with fire. Who is consuming them with fire? It is the Lord. And so you have this very astonishing contrast between the one who rules justly, and he describes that in the end of 3, 4, and 5, and the worthless men who are rulers, worthless captains. Literally, the Greek Hebrew word is captains, worthless captains. They're like thorns thrown away, and they're consumed. They're burned up. They're consumed with fire. From God's perspective, they will not last. So, it's these last words of David, and as I mentioned when we started this, I wanted you to make sure you note that he identifies himself as the sweet psalmist of Israel who spoke through or by the Spirit of the Lord. And then contrasting, he sees himself as a just ruler because of the covenant, and the worthless captains, worthless rulers, what they're like. All right. Okay, any questions? I'm not sure there are any difficult points here, but it's a marvelous. One more thing, I guess we will just introduce this, and I'm not going to read all these because about a third of these I can't even pronounce their names. But the rest of chapter 23 is an itemization of all of David's soldiers, his men, his army, and you just work your way all through it. I'm not going to read all of these, but I want to ask you a question as we, why would the Holy Spirit, who inspired the writing of the Bible and inspired the writing of chapter 23, why would the Holy Spirit want a chapter that lists all these unpronounceable names? Well, yeah, in posterity, yeah, but I mean, did you ever think about that? I mean, it's like some of the genealogies that you read, like go back to Genesis 5, for example, or a whole bunch of genealogies in the Chronicles, major part of Chronicles of genealogies. Why would God do this? Why would he list for you and me to read 2,000 years or 3,000 years later, and we have great struggle pronouncing a lot of their names? Why would Why would the Lord do this? Anybody online or here in the room, you have a thought on that?
If we knew the context, these would be very key individuals that God used to accomplish his purpose.
Does God care about each one of those individuals?
Absolutely.
He does. These individual people that we know, unless there's a little, sometimes a little phrase that describes something they did or whatever, we have no idea who they are. We have no idea what they did. Two things. One, they were very important to David. They're identified as David's mighty men. But two, they're very important to God. They are the agents God uses to accomplish his covenant promises to the children of Israel. These people are important to David the king. These are important to God. And God lists their names. And so we can even maybe go a step further. I'm assuming, and I have no reason to not assume this, I'm assuming that these people had a faith relationship with the living covenant, making God. We'll see them in heaven. And so there'll probably be Society of Cincinnati gatherings for these soldiers. Society of Cincinnati was something George Washington set up for the veterans of the Revolutionary War. So I made that up.
God doesn't forget those who served him. Right?
Exactly. And he does not. He never forgets them. And it is important for you and me, as I read this 3,000 years after these events occurred, that these men are really important to God. And if they're really important to God, and he puts them in a book that's his inspired word, it means individuals are important. And that's one of the things Jesus, I'm extrapolating, I think it's important to say this, one of the things Jesus talks about in John 10. I'm the good shepherd, and all my sheep know my name, and I know their names. God knows each one of our names. And these guys are obscure. We have no idea who most of them are. They're important to God, and he wants us to know about them. All right. Well, I think I'll stop here and pray. We have one more chapter, so I assume Fred will be here next week, but I will send to him the notes for the next section of books we're going to study, 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, because we will cover chapter 24. Chapter 24 is an odd chapter because David takes the census, and God doesn't want him to do that, and God judges him. But out of this judgment comes the location of where the temple's going to be built. Now, I want to spend a lot of time on it. We'll spend about a half hour on that next week because I want to connect Mount Moriah in Genesis 22 with the temple place that David chooses here and then Golgotha. So we're going to go 4,000 BC, 2,000 BC, and 2,000 years later, 33 AD. They all occur in the same mountain. I want to connect all those dots next week. All right? Well, I think I'll pray. Father, this session today, some hard stuff as we quickly went through chapter 22, that marvelous psalm of David, that victorious, triumphant psalm of your faithfulness to him in battle. But Lord, that's important. You fought for him because he was the recipient of your covenant. And in that final word section that we just remembered, he had a clear understanding of that covenant relationship. And we all know why that is important as well, because ultimately that leads to Jesus. It is he, the anointed one of Israel, the Messiah of Israel, who fulfills all those covenants. And that will mean, too, that in his second coming, which we are all longing for, he will finalize all aspects of that covenant and implement it as he rules and reigns on planet Earth for 1,000 years. So, Lord, as we tie all these loose ends of this important book together, and close that out next week. We ask for your continued blessing. Be with the other men who aren't here. And for those online that I don't get to see every week, may we represent you well in all we do and say in your son's name. Amen. See you next week.